Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, as promised, Jim Blackburn, our guest. Jim, a longtime apologist here at Catholic Answers. He ran the forums here, and now he's got his own apostolate, which at Catholic Answers a few years ago, we had to stop doing some of what we were doing in order to take on some new tasks. And Jim was like, you know what, I can pick up some of that. And Jim, congratulations. Today is the second anniversary of Catholic Questions and your website, catholicquestions.com.
That's right. It was 2 years ago today. You and I sat right here, and I mentioned that some other apologists and I had gotten together and decided that since the Q&A department with Catholic Answers had been closed down, for understandable reasons, that we would just go ahead and offer the idea that if people have questions, especially around the holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, families are coming home, families are getting together for meals, sharing gifts and all this, and it's inevitable that there will be questions or discussions about faith, politics and everything else, but particularly religious questions that come up. And sometimes people don't know how to respond to them. So, you know, we wanted to offer people an opportunity to ask that question when it's fresh and get an answer, you know, within a day or two, rather than having to wait till the next time Catholic Answers Live came on with the Q&A open forum. And we thought we'd do it through the holiday season, and come January, almost 2 years ago, it was still going strong. So we have continued to do it, and here it is 2 years later. And it's something that has become very popular. We have not only the website, catholicquestions.com, we have the apps for iPhone and the Google Play Store app. We have, people can write us, our address is on the website, they can call us. Anyway, that anyone needs to get a hold of us, your preference, you can find it at catholicquestions.com and contact us. So we're here to answer those questions. And if I could mention this, Cy, we're actually looking for a couple more apologists, whether it be a senior or a junior apologist. We're looking for a couple more to help us out, especially as we're getting busier now that Thanksgiving is approaching and Christmas. So if anyone's interested in that, you know, you don't have to be a professional apologist, but you need to, you know, be at a level, at least for a junior apologist, be at a level where you've been doing it a while, answering questions and helping people with apologetics, maybe giving talks at your parish, those types of things. And, you know, we consider pairing you with a more senior apologist to get you up and running in apologetics. And it's just a great springboard for what could go on to be, you know, a professional level apologetics career. So if anyone's interested, just contact us at Catholic Questions.
CatholicQuestions.com. Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah. CatholicQuestions.com. Jim Blackburn doing a great service over there. I hope you will take advantage of it. Now that you've built it, though, and you got the app and you got the website and everything, do you have any fear that Elon Musk will try to take it over?
Well, I mean, no, not at this point. At this point.
All right.
I think if he made us an offer, we might consider it, but we'd have to still run it, because the most important thing here is that these questions get answered.
But if he came to you with $44 billion, for example, and said, I'd like to own CatholicQuestions.com, you would consider the offer as long as the arrangement was right.
I'd have to talk to my attorneys, but I'd consider that, Si.
You have attorneys? Well, you would in that case. Like, you might not have them now, but you'd have them
One
then.
Of our apologists is actually an attorney by day, and he's an apologist by night. And so that thing can work out. But yeah, I'm not looking at selling off Catholic Questions. This is something that I do from my heart. We are supported by donations, and so we certainly appreciate the donations to keep us in business. But this is something that we're passionate about. We want to be answering these questions. We want to help people with their questions. And but if you talk to Elon Musk, you know, have him call me.
All right. Okay. if he calls me. 888-318-7884 is the number here where you can ask Jim your questions live. Jim Blackburn, our guest. Any question from anyone is welcome. And we're going to go to Jim in Evansville, Indiana, watching on Facebook. Jim, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for the other Jim.
Yes, it's in reference to communion. I believe the Catholic way of what communion is, but I heard someone say to a person that wasn't Catholic that their communion was not valid. So I guess my question is, why is the Catholic Church's communion valid and others aren't?
Okay, Jim. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's true that the communion that is offered, the communion services and such in most Protestant communities or evangelical communities, is not actually, they're not actually consecrating the bread and the wine or the grape juice, and they're not actually receiving the real presence or the sacrament of the Eucharist there. They're kind of going through, trying to do what they saw that Jesus did at the Last Supper, but they've lost in their theology and they've lost in their practice the real presence itself. The Catholic Church first really, I guess, kind of started experiencing this when the Reformation began and the Protestant denominations started springing up. And as these different denominations became their own, they changed some of their theology and they changed some of their sacramental practices. And we could see this live and in living color with the Anglican Church back a little over 100 years ago. Pope Leo XIII wrote a papal bull specifically about Anglican orders and thus the validity of the sacraments in the Anglican Communion. If you can read that online, it's titled Apostolicae Curae, two words, Apostolicae Curae, Latin words. Type that in as best you can and you'll find it. And he mentions in there that the theology of the Anglican Communion had lost its a lot of what it understood Jesus meant and what the church has always done when they we ordain bishops and we ordain priests. They lost that. And you cannot have valid sacraments, I mean, other than baptism, let's say, without a valid priesthood, without a valid holy order. And the Eucharist must be consecrated by a validly ordained priest or it's not going to be valid. So that's what we see in most of the Protestant communities, if not all of them, all of the large ones. It's interesting, though, Jim, that the Orthodox churches, which are not in communion with the Catholic Church, they have maintained apostolic succession, and they have maintained the theology, for the sacramental theology that's necessary to continue to have valid holy orders and to continue to have valid sacraments. So they're very different in that regard. They're very much closer to how we are in the Catholic Church, lacking really very little. Just communion with the Pope is the biggest thing that's to bring the Orthodox back into full communion with the Catholic. Protestantism and the validity of the priesthood and the validity of the sacraments, they've lost that. So does that make sense, Jim? Is he still there?
He is still there. Well, you know what? I'm going to assume that does make sense, or maybe we're having a little connection trouble. I don't know. But Jim, thank you very much for the call. I got to take this break in any case, so we'll take the break and be right back with more Open Forum with Jim Blackburn on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. You can call and ask whatever you like. 888-318-7884. Maybe you have a moral question. I want to know what the Catholic Church teaches about some moral issue. Maybe you got a Bible question. Maybe you got a question about a doctrine of the church or a practice of the church, whatever it is. 888-318-7884. The founder and still proprietor of CatholicQuestions.com is our guest, and that is Jim Blackburn. And he's very happy to take your call. 888-318-7884. I think I'm going to Mark in Boise, Idaho. Does that look right to everybody? All right. Going to Mark in Boise, Idaho. Mark, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi, Mark.
Mark? Are we having a phone problem? Mark in Boise, can you hear me? All right, I'll tell you what, Mark, I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to come back to you. So it may be just a momentary glitch that will pass. Edgar will check the line with you right now. In the meantime, we'll go to Samuel in Central California watching on YouTube. Samuel, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn. No, this is a phone problem. Okay, it's all right. Jim, we just got a phone problem.
Okay.
So if you're on the line, just hang on the line. Don't go anywhere because we'll get to your questions, and I'll give you a what we call a dropped call because we have some dropped calls. I want folks on the line to be able to ask their questions. But Mark in Boise did call, and his question was, if God is outside of time and in the eternal, how does God know if someone didn't honor the Sabbath or know of delayed obedience?
Ah, okay. Well, then I think the best way to approach that is the way we understand eternity, and this is very difficult for us in our human minds and our human experience to understand. You know, we are creatures that were created within time, and we experience time. You know, we have yesterday, today, tomorrow that we haven't experienced yet. Well, God in eternity is, we might call any point in time, along our timeline, is eternally now to God. All points of time, from the beginning of time to the end of time, are equally present to God. So God knows what happened yesterday, what's happening right now, and He knows what's going to happen tomorrow. He experiences time, I guess, in a different way than we do. Now, we don't know how our experience of time is going to be in eternity, but since God did create us as body-soul composites, and we will have bodies have motion, we do believe that there will be some experience of time in eternity for us, but we don't know how that will work compared to, you know, how it works for us now. We might have better glimpses into the past and the present and the future in our own experience of eternity than we do now. Of course, it won't be God's omniscience. God didn't create us to be omniscient, but it will be, I'm sure, very interesting, as you know, what God has prepared for those who love. St. Paul tells us it's we can only speculate on that. But God being in an eternal now, in all of time, he experiences as though it's present to him at every moment of time, at every moment of eternity. So that's how he can know those types of things. Did that answer the question, Cy, do you think?
I think that did, in fact, answer the question. But okay. I can't speak for the caller, but I can't speak to the caller either at the moment because we have a little bit of a technical problem going on. But fortunately, we do have lots and lots of questions from callers. And so I'm going to continue to read you some of the questions, but I won't be able to listen to the callers, I don't think, for a moment. I'll tell you what, let's try it. We'll see. Let's see if we can talk with Samuel in Central California, who we're trying to talk to a second ago. And Samuel is watching on YouTube. I'll tell you what, Samuel, just say hello if you're there, and then we'll know if we can hear you. Samuel, are you there with us? sure sounds like...
Hi, Samuel.
All right. We're going to come back to you, Samuel. I'll tell you what. I'm going to keep trying some lines here and see if I can get somebody on the line with us. But let's try this. Let's go to Alyssa in Sacramento. Alyssa, are you there with us?
Hi.
Hi, hello. Alyssa. Yes, you are a savior. Go ahead with your question, Alyssa.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks so much for your time. It's my first time calling in, and I got so excited. I went got through so fast. My question is around in terms of a pro-life argument. I understand that the core question when it comes to arguing for pro-life is what are the unborn? And a lot of the times we stick to science and we argue it just because we don't know where the other person is coming from, whether they believe in God and whatnot. And so a lot of times we say, well, science will say that life begins at conception, so therefore life should be protected. But I was wondering, from a place of religion, is there anything in the catechism that teaches us when a soul is there? Is the soul present at the time of conception? Is there something that the catechism teaches about that? And the reason why I ask is, if there's teaching that there is a soul at the time of conception, then obviously it's a protective life. But can someone go back and say, well, we don't really know if there's a soul at the time of conception, so therefore it should be okay to kill the unborn because it is just the body. Is there already a soul? And I'm hoping I'm making that clear.
Yeah, that seems very clear to me. Jim?
It is. And yes, God, and I'm just going to look this up real quick. Catechism mentions that in paragraph 366, the church teaches that every spiritual soul is created immediately by God. It is not produced by the parents. So immediately meaning from the moment of conception. As soon as the body, the parents provide the physical aspect, the sperm and the egg, and they come together to form a new human being that is neither the mother nor the father, immediately God creates the soul. So we have that in paragraph 366 of the Catechism.
Alyssa, does that make sense?
Exactly. Yes. Perfect sense. And that is it. That's my question. I appreciate the time.
Alyssa, hang on a quick second, because I want to ask a follow-up, and maybe you'll want to follow up on my follow-up. But the church, Jim, I just want to throw this out to you and see what you say. But the church didn't always know about conception, because we learned that from scientists who told us about how conception happens. So the church didn't always know this. But because the church knows that the life of the body begins with conception, now it's a relatively easy question to answer. When does the soul become present? Because you can't have a living human body without a soul.
That's true. But even when there was question about when ensoulment occurred, the church has always taught that once the mother knows she's pregnant, abortion is always immoral. So even when theologians were speculating about ensoulment, saying occurring at the quickening, when you first have movement from the baby, or various different theological ideas about when the ensoulment takes place, that was kind of a side argument to whether or not abortion was moral. Abortion was always considered immoral. From the time the mother knew she was pregnant until, of course, the baby was born. So that is actually a separate question.
Yeah, fair enough. Alyssa, that makes all sense? Makes sense to you?
It definitely does, and I appreciate that follow-up question. I think that's really insightful, and it definitely does. And I don't have any other follow-up questions.
All right, thanks, Alyssa. Yeah, because certainly, Jim, the church has, in its writings, one assumes in its preaching as well, opposed abortion from the first century. There was never a time when the church didn't oppose abortion. This is something people are quite deceptive about sometimes, but other people just don't know that. The record of the Catholic Church has been clear from the very birth of the Catholic Church on this.
Yes.
Samuel, I'm going to try you again in Central California, watching on YouTube. I hope we get you this time. Samuel, you there with us?
Yes.
Yay.
This is Samuel.
Go ahead, Samuel. I'm glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
All right. Lovely. Thank you so much. So as a young man who was baptized into the Catholic Church as an infant, but became a Protestant as a teenager, I wasn't able to be as deeply rooted, especially since my parents weren't really actively practicing the cultural Catholics. So I just had a question about the Blessed Theotokos. Now that I've come off of the anti-Catholic rhetoric and really anti-traditionalism rhetoric that I've experienced in my Protestant churches, so I just wanted more information as to, say, the different, I don't know if they're apparitions of the Blessed Mother, you know, like the Virgen de Guadalupe. Those have kind of confused me as a young adult now. So I would appreciate any insight on that.
Yeah, what exactly is the question? That's kind of a broad perspective.
Like,
I get that.
Sure. I'm sorry about that. I would say, so is it that the Theotokos, she's had different appearances in different parts of the world, like appeared to different people? Is that what that is? Like,
okay. Yeah, okay. I think I understand what you're saying. And let me approach it this way. First of all, you're mentioning the Theotokos, and maybe we should explain for listeners who don't know what that means. Theotokos is a term that means God-bearer. Mary was defined or was called the Theotokos at the Council of Ephesus in the year 431. So very early in church history, it was settled doctrinal matter that Mary is the Theotokos, the God-bearer. She was the mother of God. Now, this wasn't about Mary, though. This was about who is Mary the mother of. Is Mary the mother of just a human being? Is she, it was all about Jesus. Who is Jesus? And Jesus is God. Jesus is God incarnate. So Mary, as Jesus' mother, is actually the mother of God. She's the God-bearer through her pregnancy and birth of Jesus. She is the God-bearer. So that's what we mean when we use the term Theotokos. You can read more about that. The Council of Ephesus, the documents from the Council of Ephesus are widely available online. You can read more about the Theotokos there. Also in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 495, talks about the Theotokos and the various places we come to understand that Jesus or that Mary is the mother of God. Now, as far as Mary appearing down through history, there have been what are called apparitions, and those apparitions were situations where the church has looked at these claims, whether they be like the children of Fatima or the peasant in Mexico at Our Lady of Guadalupe, these types of things. The church has investigated these claims and determined these appearances of Mary to be worthy of belief. No one is required to necessarily believe in any particular apparition, except the seer, I suppose. But the church has deemed them worthy of belief, and so there can be value to them for us. If the church is recognizing that, wow, this really appears to have happened, this is worthy of belief, there could be something there, a practice, maybe a devotion, that can be beneficial to us. But none of these apparitions have added to the faith or changed the faith in any way. They are simply meant to supplement for the seer, or maybe a certain people at a certain time, supplement their faith in some way, but not add to it or change it in any way. And you can read about apparitions. There have been many, and not just of Mary, many apparitions down through the history of the church. And just go to EWTN, I believe, has a page on the various different apparitions, and read about those. And Our Lady of Guadalupe is a big one here in the Americas, of course, and Our Lady of Fatima is another one that many Americans have a devotion to. So check those out, and if you have more questions about them, contact Catholic Answers again, or contact me over at Catholic Questions, and be glad to help you more.
Samuel, I got to leave it there because we're coming up on the break, but thank you very, very much for that question. It seems like the phones are working, so we're going to keep working the phones. We'll do that right after this. Don't forget, Catholic Answers Shop, full of all kinds of great Catholic resources. Every single one of them on sale right now. Just head over to shop.catholic.com. 10, 20, 25, 50% off on some things. Check it all out. You don't need any promo code. shop.catholic.com. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As the smells fill the house for Thanksgiving, let's make each other hungry tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to more of Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Bienvenidos back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jim Blackburn is our guest. And it's almost Thanksgiving. I cannot believe it's almost Thanksgiving. It just doesn't have that Thanksgiving feel. Maybe it has that Thanksgiving feel in Buffalo, New York, where they have 7 feet of snow. But I'm not feeling the... You live up in the hills, Sarah. Does it feel Thanksgiving up there above the tree line? Yeah, it does? All right. Oh, at night it does. Yeah. At night it's getting down into the 60s around my house. It's still not a Thanksgiving feeling. It doesn't. Jim, are you feeling it? Are you feeling the Thanksgiving feeling? Are you in the holiday spirit?
It's coming up fast. It seemed to have really snuck up on us, but it's, you watch the calendar, the days tick away. We've got two celebrations of Thanksgiving this year.
What does that mean? We've got two celebrations of Thanksgiving.
Well, in my family, we have two different celebrations.
Oh, so you
my daughter is a nurse and she has to work on Thanksgiving itself. So we're doing one thing with some of the family and then another thing another day. So
that's nice. It is. Will there be multiple turkeys involved?
I believe so. Yeah.
Nice. Not good for the turkey community, but. That is very nice that your daughter, who's a nurse, gets a fresh turkey. We're going to Indiana in Salem, Oregon. watching on Facebook. Indiana, thanks for being patient with us as we've worked out these phone issues. Go ahead with your question for Jim.
Hi. So my question is about being in a state of grace. I was always told that you shouldn't really be like mad or like sad when you receive the Eucharist. But I was wondering if it just has to do with your sins or if it has to do with your emotions as well.
Okay, Indiana, good question. What it means to be in a state of grace means that we are in the state of sanctifying grace. We have sanctifying grace in our souls. And when Adam and Eve sinned, Adam and Eve were created with sanctifying grace in their souls. And when they sinned, they lost that. And in losing that, they could not produce that in their children. It was a gift from God, and when Adam and Eve lost it, they could not then give that to their future generations. So down through history, we are born, we are conceived without sanctifying grace in our souls. Sanctifying grace is that life of the soul that's necessary to live with God eternally. And since they lost that, that's why Jesus came. He came so that our sins could be forgiven and we could receive sanctifying grace in our souls. And we do that first through baptism. But we lose that sanctifying grace again when we commit a mortal sin. A mortal sin is a sin that's serious enough that it ruptures our friendship with God. And for us to be culpable of a mortal sin, we must know it's a mortal sin when we commit it. And we must freely choose to commit the sin. So if those three things are present, the gravity of the sin and the knowledge that this is a sin, a serious sin, and the freedom that we're choosing it with, we're committing a mortal sin, and we thereby lose the sanctifying grace in our souls. The way we get that back, the ordinary way, is through confession. We go to confession, we receive that sacrament, and our sins are forgiven again, and we have sanctifying grace back in our souls. So to be in a state of grace means that we have been baptized, and we have not committed a mortal sin since our baptism, or if we have committed a mortal sin since our baptism, we've been to confession to get that grace back. To follow up with your comment about the Eucharist, we never want to receive the Eucharist when we're not in the state of grace. This is teaching of the Church. In fact, to receive the Eucharist outside the state of grace is considered a sacrilege. It's another mortal sin if we know that and freely do it. So it's a sin of sacrilege to receive the Eucharist not in the state of grace. So we always want to go to confession if we are aware that we're in the state of mortal sin. And again, we cannot commit a mortal sin without knowing it. Now, the other things you mentioned, sadness or hurt feelings towards someone else, those don't always rise to the level of a mortal sin. I mean, sadness doesn't, maybe anger in our heart might, but if we've not entertained those emotions in such a way that we've lost sanctifying grace, then we can still receive the Eucharist as long as we've remained in a state of grace. If you're not sure about that, that's a good question to talk to a spiritual director about. Do you have a spiritual director, Indiana? Do you have someone you talk to about the state of your own life and your own spiritual life? A priest, or it could be a lay person.
I guess my priest.
If you don't, your priest. Okay. Well, a lot of people have. There are spiritual directors, and you can contact your parish, and have just regular meetings with your spiritual director. Meet from time to time and talk about what's going on in your spiritual life, and that person can help direct you and help you with understanding: am I in a state of grace? Am I not? Do I need to go to confession? Is it okay to receive the Eucharist? Those kinds of things. But the bottom line is, if you're in a state of grace, you may receive the Eucharist, provided you're Catholic. If you're not in the state of grace, as St. Paul says, we don't want to, we need to examine our consciences, and we need to make sure that we approach the Eucharist worthily. If we're not approaching it worthily, in other words, in the state of grace, spiritually worthy, then we're committing the sin of sacrilege. Okay?
Indiana, that all makes sense?
Oh, that made all my sense. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I'm going to go to confession tomorrow. That's why I asked.
They have a wonderful. They got Wednesday confession at your parish?
No, I had to make a meeting.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was going to say, I love those priests that hear confession midweek. But Indiana, it was great talking with you. Thanks. I hope we'll speak again.
Of course. Have a good one.
You too.
And thank you for your answers.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. God bless you, Indiana.
Well, we do Catholic Answers. You do Catholic Questions, Jim. So I think she was referring to us.
Okay.
I mean, we love you and the work that you do, but...
Well, I'm a guest here today, Cy. Come on.
Oh, yeah, that's true. All right. Okay. I won't hog it all to myself. Paul in Denver, Colorado, listening on Alexa. Paul, thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi there, Cy, and thanks for teasing my Amazon Echo. In the earlier hour when you answered a call from the guy in Virgin Island, you actually made it go silent for a few seconds. Thanks a lot.
Sorry. That's the first I've ever heard that had any effect on anyone's Alexa. And I kind of made my day, Paul. I know that's slightly evil on my part, but I'm kind of excited that it worked.
Hey, Jim, I have a question.
Yes.
I was listening to the news about this doctor who performed an abortion in Indiana. She's in a big trouble with the attorney general and everything. And it was performed on a 10-year-old girl who was pregnant. And that was shocking to me. As a pro-life, how do I defend pro-life in that situation?
Yeah, that's a tough one, huh?
Well, what's the alternative, Paul?
Well,
if you're saying the alternative is to kill the baby, I mean, how do we defend that? It's never moral to kill an innocent human being in a situation like that, to intentionally kill the baby. That's just not the answer. There must be another answer. And in the situation of even when we have a 10-year-old girl, I mean, clearly she's mature enough physically to reproduce. So I think sometimes when we think of a 10-year-old girl, we might be thinking of someone prior to that age, or prior to the having that ability to reproduce. But in this case, the girl had apparently gone through at least enough of puberty to be capable of becoming pregnant, be capable of carrying a child then, seemingly. I don't know the details on that. If this pregnancy somehow was going to be a terrible physical challenge for the girl, and therefore they thought the abortion was necessary, or if it was just because she was 10 years old. But whatever the arguments are or were, the answer is not to kill an innocent baby, that to intentionally kill an innocent baby. It could be that this girl could have carried the baby to term, had the baby and put it up for adoption, or her parents could have helped her with the child from then on. I don't know, but I do know that it's an intrinsic evil is never the right answer. And abortion is an intrinsic evil.
Paul, does that help you?
It does, because my main thought was maybe she had a very tiny body or something, but you're right. I mean, it is evil just to kill the child, so I just wanted to see how I can defend that situation.
Well, it is horrible what happened to that girl. And
it's
just that if you propose a violent solution, how is that better than a nonviolent solution? Even though there's no way to get around a horrible, vicious injustice to that girl. Paul, I really enjoyed talking with you, and thanks for listening to us on the Alexa. We'll be right back with more. Oh, you know what? Before I go, I would like to give out the phone number, because every single line's open right now for open forum with Jim Blackburn. And that is unusual. That means I haven't given out the phone. Oh, we had all those phone problems. So we lost a bunch of calls. Oh, so this is your chance. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Jim Blackburn, our guest. It's open forum. We'd love to get your call. We'll take those calls right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
More to Life is all about exploring what it means to live the Catholic difference in everything we do.
Our goal is to help people see that when they are connected to His grace, there is so much more to life.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popcheck. Tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Jim Blackburn, and we do have lines open. If you've got a question, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I'm going to give you some of the... We dropped all those calls because we had that phone problem. And so Jesse in San Antonio, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio, had called to ask, is there a program I can order online about apologetics? Where can we go to get a good explanation about the Inquisition and the Crusades?
Okay. Well, as far as the program, online program for apologetics, I mean, first thing you've got to mention, I think, is the Catholic Answer School of Apologetics, right, Cy?
Yes. And it has a class on the Inquisition, as a matter of fact.
There is one on the Inquisition as well.
Right.
That would be my recommendation, and unless you have something else to add, Cy.
No, I think we got one on the Galileo Fair as well. So all these, and then we've got the Crusades with Steve Weidenkopf. I don't know why I blanked on the great Steve Weidenkopf's name. Wonderful, wonderful historian. So I would definitely go to schoolofapologetics.com and check out all those courses. But a corresponding thing that I might mention is that pretty much every topic that's covered in one of the courses, there'll also be at least one book on it at shop.catholic.com. So there are places to go. And then for free stuff, you can always go to catholic.com and type in Crusades or Inquisition or Galileo. And then if you're like, but I need to talk to a person about this, go to catholicquestions.com.
Yes.
And a person will talk to you about it.
Absolutely. Great answer, Cy.
Thank you. Since you are an apologist, I'll just ask you this. How many millions of people were killed in the Inquisition? Like 20 million or 10 million?
Oh, I don't know the number. Do you, Cy?
No, but I know that. But I just know that people ask us.
I know
us,
that it's been outrageously...
That's what I was doing. Exaggerating
Exaggerated.
Because people will say, you know, like the Inquisition is this, millions of people killed or something. And it's not. But there were people who died in the Inquisition. But if you could find 100 of them, I'd be impressed with you. Not millions of them.
And I think it's important to mention that these people didn't actually die at the hands of the Catholic Church. They died at the hands of the government, and there's a distinction I think that needs to be made there. And of course, as you mentioned, Cy, there's a good tract at Catholic Answers. Catholic.com on the Inquisition, which explains this. There's a good article in the Catholic Encyclopedia available at Catholic.com. And then Steve Weidenkopf and his books on the Crusades and the Inquisition provide a lot more details. But the church itself, we can't necessarily hold the church itself. We might be able to hold some people in the church responsible.
Sure.
But the church itself is holy.
And yeah.
Let's leave it at that.
Yeah. The number is 888-318-7884. I do have a lot of questions for Jim. I'm going to share those questions with him. But if you'd like to get on the line and ask your question, you're welcome. 888-318-7884. I'll just say to parents, if you got little ones listening, I'm going to ask Jim a quite mature question in about 15 seconds. So if you want to do something else, that's fine for a few minutes, because I'd like to give you a little bit of warning. The number here is 888-318-7884. Jim Blackburn is our guest. And let me remind you again, if Catholic Answers has meant a lot to you and you want to share what it's meant to you, we're doing a kind of a cool thing for Giving Tuesday on Instagram. If you would like to participate in our Instagram Giving Tuesday thing, then what you do is you record a story-length video, something less than 15 seconds, saying why you love Catholic Answers, what Catholic Answers has meant to you, and then send us the video in the DMs. Slide into our DMs. Is that how they say it? A direct message? Is that right, or did I say it wrong? That's what I've heard. On or before Giving Tuesday, November 29th, and then watch for your testimony and others that we're going to share on Instagram. Jim, I said I was going to ask you a kind of a mature question, and I think it's a very good and important question. So I didn't want to just ignore it, but Santi was not able to stay on the phone with us because we had a little phone problem, but in Minnesota, was listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the question is very simple and direct. Is it a mortal sin for a Catholic married couple to use the withdrawal method?
Okay. It's a grave sin, certainly, because to frustrate the conjugal act in order to try to prevent pregnancy is immoral of itself. And if the couple does this knowing that it's grave matter and they're freely choosing to do it, even though they know it's contrary to God's law, then yes, it would be a mortal sin for them to use that method. Any method which frustrates the ordinary act, the conjugal act, is immoral. A married couple must always, their sexuality must always be ordered toward procreation. That doesn't mean it always has to be procreative, but they cannot themselves introduce something into the conjugal act to frustrate it. If they choose to engage in the conjugal act for a time only when the wife is infertile, you know, this is what NFP tries to do. Those kinds of ways of avoiding pregnancy for a time when you have a good reason can be moral, but not a situation like the withdrawal method or the use of contraceptives and such.
I have to say, sometimes this is the one that people have the hardest time with about that, is that why is it okay to refrain from intercourse during infertile periods, but it's not okay to use other methods? And because I think it's hard for people to see, well, why is that different? So could you explain why that's different? Because the church does not say that you must just take a laissez-faire approach. You're not obligated to that. You can, in fact, I mean, no one is obligated by the church to have intercourse on any particular day at any particular time.
So, that's right.
So why is that perfectly acceptable, but it's not acceptable, for example, to use the other methods that you described?
Yeah, we have to draw a distinction between the end, you know, what is it that we're looking to accomplish here or not accomplish. We have to draw a distinction between that and the means to that end. There are moral means to getting pregnant. Rape is not a moral means to pregnancy. There are moral means to avoiding pregnancy, abstaining from intercourse during the fertile time of the wife's cycle is a moral means to avoiding pregnancy. Frustrating the conjugal act in order to avoid pregnancy is not a moral means. Now, it's not a moral means because the only time sexual activity really is ever moral is between a husband and a wife, in a completed act, completed conjugal act, that must be ordered toward procreation. And that word ordered is very important. The act does not have to be procreative of itself, for example, during an infertile period, but it must still remain open to that, must be remain ordered toward that. If we're frustrating the order of the act itself, then we're bringing something in that's contrary to the morality of the act. So those are the distinctions to be made. Sai, it's really a matter of the means that are immoral. The end itself may be immoral or not. A married couple who wants to space the births of their children and have maybe financial reasons to do that, it's perfectly moral to attempt to avoid pregnancy for a time, to use the natural family planning method for that. But to introduce another means that is not moral, such as frustrating the act, that's never okay to do.
One of the things that I always wish we could do, but we don't always have time to do it, and we do have time to do it today, is to say how beautiful this teaching is, how it is not an, it can be a difficult teaching to follow, but it's not onerous, and it has wonderful effects in marriage. And among the effects, for men certainly, is being more in tune with the wife's body, understanding her cycle more, and understanding and what she goes through in the course of her cycle, and kind of learning a kind of restraint and patience that you might mm-hmm. not other within the context of marriage that you might not learn otherwise.
Yeah, I get over the years, you know, people saying, "Oh, you Catholics have such a rigid view of sex. You think it's bad. You think it's dirty. It's only for one thing and one thing only. And so we must somehow think that it's bad and think that it's dirty." It's actually, if you understand Catholic theology behind it, it's just the opposite. We see the conjugal act as one of the most beautiful acts that we can engage in as human beings. It's a oneness shared between the husband and wife. That's just a beautiful show of love for one another. And we maybe then put that up on a pedestal a little bit, and it should be, because to engage in that outside of what it's intended for, that loving act between a husband and a wife, ordered towards procreation and the good of the spouses, is to use it outside of that is to abuse it. And all of these other things, you know, masturbation, same-sex sexual activity, adultery, fornication, all of these kinds of things, they are the ones that really cheapen sex, cheapen intercourse, make it something that it's not. They seek to provide or receive enjoyment from it without any consequences, without the responsibility that goes along with it. But when a husband and wife engage in the conjugal act, being responsible and it's truly a loving act, open to procreation and the good of the spouses, the good of each other, the good of the marriage, it's actually a beautiful thing. We don't think it's dirty. We don't think it's somehow a bad thing. We see it as the beautiful act that it is that God created
right.
for us.
And I really do think it's a better deal for women, because men come into a different relationship with their wife when they're respecting her body and not asking her to put chemicals in her body, not asking for other
yes.
things. But respecting her body.
Not treating her as an object.
Yeah.
Treating her as his wife, spouse.
Jim Blackburn, you're awful good at this. I'm really glad you were here.
I'm awful? Did you say?
I said you're awful good at this, Jim.
Oh.
But I also want to say again, congratulations. Today, second anniversary of the founding of CatholicQuestions.com. And you've been doing it every day since, and it's a magnificent service you do, and I hope we'll be able to keep supporting you in it and sharing it with other people, and that you'll just get to keep doing it for a long time.
Thanks so much, Sai. God bless you. Thanks for having me on today.
CatholicQuestions.com is where you can go to ask Jim and his apologist friends questions directly. You can always find us at Catholic.com, and we'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.